Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigators, along with noted consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Danny Gruden, retired investigator and author, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of the game. CrimeWire is a place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or a family member and you'd like to send CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death, please email us at crimewire@gmail.com.
Scott Bonds, the Assistant Professor of Sociology at Drew University in Madison, New Jersey. Dr. Bonds joined the sociology faculty at Drew in 2007. He received his Ph.D. in sociology from the University of Miami, his M.S. in criminal justice from San Jose State University, and his B.A. in journalism from Kent State University. He teaches courses in criminology, deviance, and the criminal justice system, and the effects of media and political rhetoric on public attitudes and opinion. He has published on the importance of higher education for police officers, Policing International. He has presented papers at many criminology conferences and published articles in peer-reviewed journals such as Policing International, Deviant Behavior, Race and Social Problems, and Critical Criminology. He is also the author of a book titled Mass Deception, Moral Panic and the U.S. War on Iraq from Rutgers University Press. He is currently working on a book tentatively titled Monster Dearest, Our Fascination with Serial Killers and Why We Need Them. Dr. Bond is the faculty advisor to WMNJ, the student-operated radio station at Drew. Dr. Bond, welcome to CrimeWire.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
And tonight we're going to be talking about, of course, serial killers, be one of the topics, and in specific, the Long Island serial killers. Have you thought about or delved into the Long Island cases at all?
Very much so. As a matter of fact, it's been a focus of my attention ever since the first bodies that were linked to this unknown perpetrator back in December of 2010. So, yes, I've been following it very closely.
For the listeners who aren't familiar, would you want to give some background on this whole situation and how it caught your attention?
Sure. Well, it all started with the disappearance of a prostitute by the name of Shannon Gilbert in the summer of 2010, actually June of 2010. And the investigation for this young woman, who was a prostitute who worked through Craigslist, online service, led to the discovery of four bodies on Gilgo Beach in Long Island in December of 2010, so about 6 months after they began looking for Shannon Gilbert. Now, where this really starts to take twists and turns is that Shannon Gilbert was not one of the bodies among those found. That these four women who were found, and they were found discarded along the side of the road in burlap sacks, were all quickly determined to be women who were known to be missing prostitutes who had been contacted. Their last call before they went missing was through Craigslist. And so it was at that point that the police began to realize that there was a likelihood that there was a serial killer operating. And then in April of 2011, the following spring, an additional six bodies were found in the same general area within a 3.5-mile radius. And among them were some more women. And then, unusually, and not seeming to fit the pattern, a young Asian male, who was later determined to be cross-dressed approximately 20 years old, cross-dressed as a female, believed also to be a sex worker, and a baby wrapped in a blanket. So at that point, there were a total of 10 bodies that were in some way believed to be linked. And even more recently, there have been a couple of additional bodies that have been found which may be linked. And then perhaps the most amazing fact of all is that almost 1 year to the day after the initial bodies were found in December of 2010, then the body of Shannon Gilbert was found in December of 2011. And however, the police are suggesting that Shannon Gilbert is not a victim of the Long Island serial killer, even though she was found in the same general area. They believe that she actually drowned, that she ran from a house, and she seemed desperate, and she was actually knocking on doors to receive help, but they believe that she fell down and drowned. And I don't believe that that is the likelihood, but nevertheless, that's what law enforcement believes. And
can I ask you, Doc, if that's, if they're saying that, is it because that case prompted to have to move on this, and they're trying to say, no, this didn't happen this way, because it was such a sore thumb to them.
Yes, so I agree.
How can you find that in that area then? It doesn't make any sense. I mean, that's why they were out there looking for Shannon.
Yes. Well, what happened was by December of 2010, there was such pressure from the families of the women who had been identified, as well as Shannon Gilbert, to come to some sort of resolution that I think that, that led to the discovery of Shannon Gilbert. But it makes no sense to me. They're once again, they're suggesting that she somehow, Shannon Gilbert, was running away from a house and that she fell down and drowned in a swamp, and which is where her body was found. And the fact that she had been contacted through Craigslist, that she was known to be a sex worker on Craigslist, so, and she's a young white woman who fits the profile of the women who were killed by this unknown individual, and the fact that she was found in the very same area as the other bodies is just all too coincidental. Probability would suggest that there's a linkage here. And as a criminologist, I mean, I just can't accept the fact that she just somehow fell down and drowned. It doesn't seem reasonable to me.
So does that help the cases from years ago, the first bodies that they would unearth recently? Does that help then in determining perhaps the person, if the person made a mistake, or the drowning a cover-up because the other bodies are so old?
Well, the bodies that were most recently found, there was a body found in February of this year and one in March. And the reason that they are believed to be linked to the others is that they were found in a town called Manorville, also on Long Island. But however, this area is 40 miles away from Gilgo Beach, where the other bodies were found. But the reason there may be a linkage is that two of the women who were discovered on Gilgo Beach were dismembered, and their torsos were actually also discovered right there in Manorville, in that same wooded area. So that's why there is a strong likelihood that these cases are linked. Now, with these latter two bodies, they had been there for a while, at least 5 years, and it hasn't even been disclosed yet whether they're male or female. So there's still a big question mark in regards to these last two bodies that were found.
Doctor, am I correct in that all these bodies, with the exception of Shannon Gilbert, are clear homicides? Now, is Shannon being classified as an accidental drowning?
That's what they're suggesting, that she, in fact, it was an accidental drowning. And again, I don't, unless there's information that they're simply not disclosing, which I find hard to believe, I don't think we can rule out the possibility of foul play, and specifically that she is related to this case. Some of the bodies are unidentified. The five of the bodies have been identified, and this is excluding Shannon Gilbert, but five of the bodies have been identified. They have all been linked to the sex trades and to Craigslist specifically. Some of these other bodies have not been identified. The Asian male has not been identified, and the baby has not been identified. However, the baby, who was wrapped in a blanket and found in the same general area on Gilgo Beach, has been linked by DNA to one of the women. And these women, many of these women have been, the belief is that they were either strangled or smothered. The male, the Asian male, died from head trauma. They believe that his head was bashed in. And I believe that there is one serial killer who's operating, who is likely to be responsible for all of these murders. Now, that is disputed by the new homicide chief, Jack Fitzgerald, who's claiming that there are multiple killers. His predecessor, Jack Dormer, who is no longer there, believed that there were multiple killers. So clearly there's still controversy, even among the police department, exactly what's going on. But the reason that I believe that these cases are linked is, let's say that this Asian male, in fact, is a cross-dressed sex worker, as they believe that he was. Well, if he was picked up by the Long Island serial killer and believing that he was, in fact, a woman, and when the killer found out that it was not a woman, he might have gotten downright angry and bashed the individual's head in and still dumped that individual in his favorite burial ground there on Gilgo Beach. The thing that I'd like to impress upon your listeners is that just from a law of probability, and as a criminologist, I work with patterns, I work with probabilities, it's a far greater likelihood that there's one serial killer responsible for all of these murders than the likelihood that there are multiple killers using the same very isolated, desolate area to dump bodies. And so it's simply from a probability standpoint, it's one individual. And I think that we can, again, make a very strong case that these individuals are linked. Even the child. It's known that prostitutes, when they go on calls, on tricks with their clients, will take a baby with them if they have one, because these are oftentimes women who do not have means. There's no prostitution daycare that I'm aware of, so it's not unusual for a prostitute to take a baby along.
Doctor, you said the first four bodies that were discovered when the search started for Shannon were all burlap bagged. Were any of the other bodies discovered later in burlap, or was it just
no? And no, they were not. And in fact, here's where it, once again, as we said at the beginning of the hour, it's such a fascinating case because it just takes so many twists and turns. The bodies that were found in December of 2010, even though they were discovered most recently, they were in fact the ones of the entire group that were also murdered most recently, and meaning within the last couple of years. They were all went missing and were killed within the last couple of years. They were rather recklessly just dumped in these burlap sacks along the side of the road. The bodies that were found in the following April were covered in plastic, and many of them were dismembered, and there was a much greater attempt to conceal the bodies and, in fact, to actually discard body parts throughout the area, including as far away as Manorville, 40 miles away. So my theory is, and again, this is based upon my knowledge and studying the patterns of serial killers and profiling, is that what we have is a serial killer who's evolving. The bodies that were found in April of 2011, some of them had been there as long as 15, 16 years. That's how long that they had been there. And I think what we have is an individual who started out very meticulously, very carefully, attempting to hide bodies, dismember them, and discard them in a fashion that they couldn't be found. And what he discovered over time is that because he was killing prostitutes, and many of them runaways who had been estranged from their families, they simply weren't reported. They weren't discovered or reported for years. And when he realized that it wasn't necessary to go to such effort to hide the bodies, he became a little more reckless, a little more, as we call it, disorganized in his behavior, and just dumped them in bags along the side of the road. You know, it's not an easy thing to dismember a body and discard it. It's a lot of work, and it leaves a lot of trace evidence. So I think we have an individual who's becoming more of a risk taker over time.
Were any of the examinations of the remains able to determine if there had been any sexual assault or activity around the time of the death?
They haven't disclosed that. You know, most of these bodies are in tremendous state of decomposition. So it's very, very difficult even to determine cause of death, although they believe strangulation or smothering in many of these cases. But they have not said that. They have not said that. The thing about serial killers and then another thing that I'd like to, you know, just to clarify for the audience is that the motivations of serial killers are very varied, very different. And some of them, sex is the primary motivation or sexual perversion, sexual torture. For others, it's not. In some cases, it's more the power and the control and the killing itself. And I think what we have here is likely an individual who is motivated by the torture, by the control and power that he exerts over these individuals, but he's also sadistic, and that is exemplified by the fact that one of his victims, Melissa Barthelemy, he actually took her cell phone and called her sister, the victim's sister, 6 times over a 7-week period, just to taunt her and torment her, and she knew that it was the killer on the phone because he said, you know, what he had done to her sister. So this is an individual who is really diabolical and gets off frankly on tormenting and torture.
So then, is that his claim to fame with the cell phone? I mean, serial killers don't do that, do they?
Well, once again, it varies. Some of them love attention. You know, some of them absolutely love attention. Dennis Rader, the bind, torture, kill strangler, and David Berkowitz, they sought the headlines. David Berkowitz corresponded with reporters, and including Jimmy Breslin. So sometimes they love it. Sometimes they actually love the attention.
Doctor, I got a question here, and hopefully you'll have an answer for me. Let's assume that the speculation about the cause or manner of death of these people, with the exception of Shannon, that the strangulation or suffocation, smothering, is accurate.
Mm-hmm.
If that is true, does that tell you anything about the killer? Is there some message that can be derived from the manner that he chooses to use?
Oh, sure. Well, serial killers who use their hands, it's oftentimes there is a sexual nature to it. They like to touch the bodies. They like to control. And strangulation is a particularly personal way to kill. And you actually, I'm sorry to be graphic, but you're squeezing the life out of an individual. And it's BTK, for example, that was his method of killing, strangulation. And he has said that at the moment that he extinguished their lives, that he was God. And so he is the epitome of a power control killer. And that it's the killing itself and the torturing that gives him that high and feeds his fantasy and emotional needs. So yes, I suspect that this is a similar type of individual. He really gets off on the fact that he has the control and power over life and death.
And from that, the killer obtaining or getting some type of gratification or satisfaction. With these, you know, the personal method of the strangulation, where where the victim might be looking into your eyes for part of this process. And I have, I believe, heard of cases, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but where some of these killers could actually let the victim get on the verge of blacking out and then release the grip a little bit to prolong things, let him take another breath.
Yes.
Have you ever heard of such a thing as that?
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's exactly what BTK did in his killings. He would torture them almost like a cat would torture a mouse. They play with the mouse and almost, you know, kill it and then let it revive. Well, yes. In fact, serial killers do that. Ed Kemper did that. John Wayne Gacy would do that. So yes, that's not an unfamiliar pattern at all. The thing about psychopaths, and I believe that this gentleman, I use the term loosely, but this killer is a psychopath, and a psychopath is someone who is just completely disconnected from society, has no empathy, has no emotional connection with other people, and simply believes that the rules and laws and norms of society just don't apply to them. And someone like this, it's almost an experiment. It's almost that they enjoy just seeing how people will react under those kind of conditions. And because it means nothing to them, the torture, the pain, the torment that they're putting the individuals through, it doesn't mean anything to them. They find it just interesting. An interesting thing to amuse themselves. And I know that's almost incomprehensible for us to understand, but nevertheless, that is the way that some of these individuals operate.
Let me just ask you one more thing out of curiosity here. Let's go to the Asian male for a moment. Mm-hmm. Assuming that he was also a victim of the same murderer.
Mm-hmm.
And he was killed, and I think your theory certainly makes sense that the reason there was not a strangulation or smothering was because the killer became enraged when he realized his victim wasn't what he thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
Now, would that be because he's angry, apparently, and, you know, the violence of bashing someone's head in? That eliminates a little bit maybe that personal thing of toying, you know, with the slower process of the strangulations. So
mm-hmm.
would that be, do you think, from the killer's perspective, a less satisfying experience?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, he didn't get what he wanted. And the interesting thing about certain serial killers, especially the ones that are true psychopaths, is they have almost a strange sense of principles. That they operate on a logic and a set of principles that make sense to them that doesn't necessarily make sense to us, but yet they believe that it's perfectly valid. So it's from the perspective of this killer, he likely thought that he was deceived. You know, I thought I was picking up a woman. How dare you deceive me and conceal the fact that you're actually a man? So therefore, you get what you deserve, and so the kind of rage that might bring out in the killer once again is consistent with these individuals. So, but yes, to fully answer your question, in all likelihood, it would not have given him the satisfaction that he wanted.
So, would he kill where he knew? Is that the one specific identifying component to all these people, that they kill where they know?
Say that again, that the killer what?
The killer, does this one and all of them kill where they know the
oh.
area, they know, they're so familiar that they get away with it.
Yeah, well, I believe that this individual who's doing the killing is very intimately familiar with the Gilgo Beach area. It's a very isolated area of Long Island, a strip of beach, and at night it's just pitch dark. I mean, if you're trying to navigate that area at night, there are very few lights. And so I think there's an excellent chance that this individual grew up in that area. And also another very important set of facts about this case: all of the women, including Shannon Gilbert, who have been identified, the sex workers who have been identified, they disappeared between May and September of the given year in which they went missing. So there's a seasonal aspect to this, and I think that there's a distinct possibility that this is an individual who used to live on Long Island and may come back and vacation in that area, take summers in Long Island. It's a beach area. It's a seasonal recreational area. It's a very good possibility that he may even have a summer home in the area. Another possibility, because he made these phone calls, the police have traced those half a dozen phone calls that he made to Melissa Barthelemy's sister, were made from Midtown Manhattan. They were able to triangulate the calls to Midtown Manhattan. So it's possible that he is also a Manhattan resident and has a weekend house in Long Island. So
that would be he could possibly have means. He has money. Maybe he's somebody that's a prom.
Yes. I think this is an educated man. I think that he is likely professional. I think that he's probably either in a relationship and perhaps even married. This is what we call an organized killer and a meticulous planner. This is a Ted Bundy type of killer. This is not a slash and a predatory type killer like Jack the Ripper, who just jumps out of the shadows and slashes and kills. This is someone who plans and meticulously orchestrates their work.
I mean, even to have a cell phone in Manhattan, you've got to make some money. This is not a cheap area just to even walk through.
That's right. Well, the cell phone was the sister's cell phone. But the fact that he made these calls over a 6-week period, so we know for a fact that he was in Manhattan at least during that time frame.
Doctor, can a guy like this, speaking of the time frame where there seems to be a pattern time wise of when these people disappeared, the victims, now can somebody like this guy turn it on and off? In other words, can he go and just kill during like a 4-month period a year, or is there something where he'd have to find other victims in the other 8 months, or can he turn it on and off and wait till the time is right, or should
no.
there be bodies in Manhattan, and you know what I'm saying? Should there be other victims during the other time?
Sure. No, I understand your question, and serial killers are not seasonally motivated. Their desire to kill does not come seasonally. And so therefore, and just following through in your question, if this is in fact someone who is transient, someone who is coming into the area during the summer months, then the FBI has to be looking at patterns elsewhere, similar patterns elsewhere. And that's certainly what I would be doing, and the FBI is very much involved in this case, so they have to be doing that. And the other thing is that because his burial ground has now been discovered, it was discovered almost 2 years ago, December of 2010, it's possible that he already has another burial ground. I mean, he may be operating, he may have another burial ground that he's using right now, and the police simply don't know about it. You know, a serial killer only becomes a serial killer when the pattern is detected and the bodies are identified. And that's why there have been serial killers who have operated over the centuries that were never even identified as serial killers, because law enforcement and crime scene investigation techniques weren't at such a place to even link the killings.
And like you mentioned earlier, the class of victims he chooses, the people who may not have close friends or family and so forth, and are kind of people of the night and so on, who knows how many victims could be out there that they just haven't had someone report them.
Exactly.
Nobody's
exactly.
looking for them.
That's right. And you bring up such an important point. And there have been so many serial killers who have preyed upon women like this. Joel Rifkin is a classic example, the most prolific serial killer in the state of New York, in the history of the state of New York, and killed 17 prostitutes back in the 90s. And he said, well, yes, of course I killed prostitutes. They're easily found. They're on the streets. They will get in your car. They will go with you. And because of the fact that they are frequently runaways and estranged from their families, they can go unreported and missing for long periods of time. So, in a very macabre sort of way, they're the ideal prey for a serial killer.
And doctor, let me ask you this about police. I'm assuming, now I'm not talking just about this Long Island one, but serial killers in general. Mm-hmm. Depending on where they operate or where their victims are discovered, I'm assuming that on occasion they're in the jurisdictions, perhaps, of police agencies that aren't maybe small agencies or whatever, that don't have a detector bureau or don't have a laboratory and don't have the means or the know-how or experience to really handle what could be a very complex thing such as a serial killer in the loose. Has that ever happened where they need to bring in outside help because the agency with initial jurisdiction maybe just isn't equipped to handle that type of thing?
Well, absolutely, and that's why the FBI really organized their behavioral profiling unit back in the 70s, and some of the individuals who were really responsible for developing that for the FBI, people like John Douglas and Roy Hazelwood, to name just the two of the pioneers, were really the ones who were on the cutting edge of profiling serial killers and serial rapists, and they maintain a database in Quantico, Virginia, of known serial killers and serial rapists, and they keep all of the details, all the facts and information of known cases where the killer has been identified. And so, as you suggested, local law enforcement agencies will call in the FBI, and the FBI will look at the facts of a case in a local jurisdiction and try to match it up with patterns of known killers from the past. And that's the way that profiling, one of the primary ways that profiling is done, is trying to match or connect the dots in unknown cases with patterns from the past. It's an inductive technique. It's looking at specific facts, case evidence, and trying to match it up to previous patterns. And it's not an exact science, it's more of an art in many ways than a science, but nevertheless it can be very, very effective.
Is there equipment now developed for almost under earth to look for bones, to look for remains in cases like this? Is that how they were able to so successfully find all of these bodies? I mean, they're so spaced apart. How is it that police stumble upon so many at one time when they do the initial dig out there?
Well, there have been hundreds, literally hundreds of police who have been involved in these investigations. The area out there on Gilgo Beach is just covered with thicket and thorns and poison ivy. It's dense. It's probably millions of dollars have already been spent in this investigation because they've had boats and helicopters and cranes looking over the area meticulously, with a fine-tooth comb almost, going over these beaches, miles and miles and miles of these beaches. So there's been, it's not like there hasn't been tremendous manpower thrown at it, but to answer your question, Susan, these bodies were found in clusters. These 10 bodies were found essentially over a 3.5-mile radius, but in two pockets, in two groups. The first group found in December of 10, and then the second group of six found in April, March and April of 11. So they're scattered over 3.5 mile radius, but nevertheless, it's in concentrations. And each time they found that they made a discovery, within a matter of days, they found then the multiple bodies. And I just wanted to also just follow up with what you were saying before, Susan, that it is absolutely true that serial killers like to operate in areas that they know well, where they have a comfort zone, and they will go back to it time and time again. And I believe that now that this burial ground, and this is sacred ground to this individual, the killer, this is truly sacred ground to him, this burial ground. I believe that he's going back to it. I believe that he is actually gaining tremendous satisfaction. It's feeding his emotional and psychological needs, the fact that all of this attention is being paid to it. But at the same time, his urge to kill is not going to go away. He's smart, and he's going to find another area. His urge to kill is not going to just disappear. He's good at it, and he's gotten away with it for 15 or 16 years now, and he's not going to stop.
Doctor, when you get a guy like this or any other serial killer, is there a good, effective way or a way that has a possibility of working to aggressively go after this person? Or do you have to, if you're a police agency, do you have to kind of wait till the guy makes a mistake? You know,
what?
For example, let me just say that. Okay, let's say there's something to the seasonal aspect of that area, you know, the Long Island area with this guy. Could, for example, there be an undercover police officer, FBI agent advertised on Craigslist starting in May, hoping, you know, that type of a situation, trying to lure the guy out, or do they just have to wait and find a body and hope he left some kind of evidence?
Well, these are great questions, and there's not an easy answer. The fact that some of these individuals, particularly the more notorious ones like Bundy and BTK and the Green River Killer, the fact that they were able to operate for so long and kill so many people means that they were very, very good at it. And because of their antisocial personality disorders, which is really what psychopathy and sociopathy are, antisocial personality disorders, they have this meticulous ability to do these things and do so without any sort of emotional reaction or fear or remorse. So they don't make many mistakes. You know, they're just very meticulous. And the way that some of these individuals are caught is they eventually become a little bit sloppy, and they almost become cavalier and reckless in their approach. That's how Joel Rifkin was caught. He was caught when he was driving around with a decomposing body in the trunk of his car, the 17th of his victims, and he had just reached a point where it was a bit mundane, and so he was driving around with a corpse in his trunk. BTK got caught, the Vine Torture Kill Strangler, got caught because he was playing cat and mouse with law enforcement and the newspapers over a period of almost 30 years, and they traced one of his letters to the church where he had typed it on a computer using the computer where he was the president of the church association, his Lutheran church. And so they got him as a result of his own ego. So it's, you know, sometimes they don't catch them because they, you know, in the midst of a killing, or because they leave evidence at the scene of the crime. Sometimes they catch them just because they get bored or they are victimized by their own ego, which can be their Achilles heel in their undoing sometimes.
That brings down people more than serial killers. A lot of people end up in the
yeah.
soup because their egos get the best of them. You know, I was just thinking about what you said and we've talked about earlier and what Mr. Rifkin said about the prostitutes as victims. And you know, there it is. Not only might people not report them as missing so quickly or at all, but you've got because they will go with you. They will get in your car. You don't have to have an altercation on the street of trying to kidnap someone, you know, screaming and kicking, trying to get away and bringing all kinds of attention. So you got up to a point, you have a willing victim, I mean, who is going to meet you where you want to meet, get in the car with you without a fuss and go to wherever. So, you know, that's a tremendous, I think, from the killer's standpoint, a tremendous asset, a tremendous benefit.
Oh, absolutely. And Joel Rifkin has said that very thing. And they, of course, they are sex objects. I mean, that is what you're doing. When you contact a prostitute on Craigslist or pick her up on the street corner, as Joel Rifkin did in his truck, I mean, they are selling their bodies. They're selling sex. And that is certainly part of the allure and part of the appeal to these men who are doing the killing. And the, you know, the sad thing is that, you know, one of the tragedies of all this is, you know, these are women who have already been marginalized in society. They you know, women don't choose, or men for that matter, who are engaged in the sex trades. These are not individuals who have happy lives and who have you know, fulfilled lives and grew up in you know, positive environments for the most part. These are individuals who have already suffered abuse and been oftentimes traumatized that led them to the streets to begin with, and you know, then they become, you know, victims of serial killers, and I know that Susan and I share this belief that oftentimes they're treated very unfairly and in very negative terms by the media. That they're almost blamed for their own murders. That, well, if they hadn't been a prostitute, you know, that maybe they hadn't gotten killed. As if somehow they were, you know, that they're not really victims. That they're somehow responsible for their own plight. And that's just, you know, that's just wrong.
Yeah, and it's, now that we're talking about this, I think Susan would agree with me. We, on occasion, have cases where the victim was not necessarily a prostitute, but a street person type, you know, in a very similar situation to the prostitute. And when someone tried to report them as a missing person to the police, they kind of got poo-pooed. Hey, you know, the cops, and I'm not saying that happens all the time, but I guess there could be cases where
you are. Wait a minute, looks correct.
Okay.
It happens all the time, okay?
Frequently, sure.
So, yes.
Yes. Well, that's been, you know, that has been the charge in this case. The families of the victims, the ones who have been identified, and including Shannon Gilbert, the families are outraged. They believe that they haven't received as much attention as they should, and that if their daughters had been something other than prostitutes, that this would be treated differently. And I've said before, and I'll say it again, that if this Long Island serial killer was killing Wall Street executives rather than sex workers, this would be the biggest story in the United States, and would be the only thing you'd hear on the news every day. But that's not the case.
You know, you brought up a good point when they reopened Natalie Wood's case, and I interviewed you for Forbes magazine back in December on this. And after decades, they open up the Natalie Wood case. It's cold. And they get more exposure than the Long Island killer cases.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
That's sad.
And, you know, it is. It is. And but these women, you know, these women are marginalized, unfortunately. And it's really a sign of the value that society places on these individuals. And it's, you know, it's tragic. And that's why I find this the way that that Shannon Gilbert is being treated is just wrong. You know, it's almost trivializing it to say, well, she just fell down and drowned in the swamp somehow. We the facts are that this woman was frantically pounding on doors in the neighborhood there, screaming for her life. And so she obviously had something to fear, and she was trying to escape from something. And to claim that she just fell down and drowned, is to me is very cavalier and very just wrong. And I there's something going on here that we don't know about. I just think that there's more facts that are missing here, and I don't know what it is, but I hope we get.
Yeah, they know who
the
killer is, and they haven't gone in for the kill or the arrest yet. And that's part of this. I mean, they allegedly, from sources, do know who this person is, and I don't know why they haven't arrested this person. Is this guy that clever? And it really goes back to what we said at the beginning of the show. They're so mad. They're so upset. That it's Gilbert's case that makes everybody open their eyes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's her mother that will not, like mother should, like these people, will not let go.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what causes everybody and prompts them into action.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, John Douglas is either retired or ready for retirement.
Mm-hmm.
New blood is someone like you. That should be called in to this type of a case. Not so much to document and chart, but to help them. Because I think there's a lot of a case this big, are there that many experts can really help them? Because of all these jurisdictions, does it muddy the waters for the success of an arrest?
Well, I think that clearly they're in confusion and disarray. They're in in Suffolk, because the former police commissioner was replaced, and so you now have a new homicide chief, and they clearly don't have a real profile and strategy for who they believe this individual is, and certainly how to ascertain them. And so, consequently, I agree with you. We need much more of a focus on this case.
So and I think when your class go in there, or you and really, and because you're so close to this area. And almost like a way that they do it in the cold case, and really be brought in, I think you could do a lot of good. I think that you could really be able to, in real time, do a lot for the investigation.
Well, it would be my pleasure. It would be my pleasure. But I haven't received a call yet, but it would be my pleasure to do so.
Let's see if we can make that happen. I mean, you know, I think that that's what will help. Plus, any time the university is in there doing research, at the same time these crimes happen.
Mm-hmm.
Then I think that you have outcome that is measured and successful, and that the person is likely caught. I mean, everybody thinks that this guy's a Hannibal Lecter, but you're saying he's not.
No, I don't think he is. I think he is an individual who would blend in very easily. You know, the thing about psychopathic killers is they can be very disarming and even charming, and I think that this individual fits that bill. But no, he's not the Hannibal Lecter evil genius type. Which, by the way, you know, I mean, Hannibal Lecter, it makes for good entertainment, but he was really a composite of a lot of different serial killers, and there's no serial killer that I'm aware of who, you know, is quite that spectacularly. Genius as Hannibal Lecter, but nevertheless, they can still be very difficult to apprehend as this one is. And
what's our fascination with these kind of crimes? As a society, what's our fascination with these kind of crimes?
Thank you for that segue, Susan. I mean, that's my research right now. That's what I'm working on, and. I think we're fascinated by these individuals, partially just by the incomprehensibility of their deeds. We just can't understand how someone can cold-bloodedly stalk and torture and kill a complete stranger. It's just, you know, it's incomprehensible to our natures, And yet it makes for this amazing whodunit. You know, I mean, this is just this whole Long Island serial killer case is the making of a movie. And I'm sure there will be movies made about it. So it's a whodunit story. It's a live, real time whodunit story. And the nature of our society now is we feed on the spectacular, we feed on the sensational, and part of the theory that I'm putting forth is that a situation like this, like the Long Island serial killer or any high profile murder case for that matter, is entertainment until that individual or that case touches your own life. You know, if the Long Island serial killer preys upon your neighbor or someone in your family, suddenly it's not entertainment anymore. But until they do, it's just another form of escapism. And so therefore, you know, we have the same fascination for Jack the Ripper, the Long Island serial killer, Ted Bundy, or Hannibal Lecter. It's all the same thing until it touches our own lives. And I think also that there's this notion of, how smart is this individual? How long can he outsmart the police? We're fascinated by the detective story. And I think it also appeals to our, we all have a tendency or at least a predisposition toward the dark side. You know, we might say to ourselves, man, I could just kill my boss. Yeah, that guy really ticks me off, man, I could really kill him. But we don't do it. You know, we don't do it. Whereas these individuals do. And I think it sort of appeals to our own sense of what are we capable of under certain circumstances, you know. So
but these guys are no different than, aren't they just the similar mobsters? We watched all the James Kennedy and George Raft and all these movies when we were growing up, and Denny is a prolific author in mob, and he's done books with former mobsters.
Yeah.
You know, why are we fascinated with that and put them in hero status? And
yeah,
they're killers.
Well,
they're serial killers.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And I think, you know, these individuals, Jack the Ripper, the Boston Strangler, the Long Island serial killer, they're just another version of the creature, the wolf man, and the Frankenstein monster. And I think that part of the appeal is also, it's an adrenaline rush. You know, why do we go to monster movies? We go to monster movies to get the bejesus scared out of us for $10 now or $12, whatever the cost of a movie is. And it's the same thing. It's an adrenaline rush that we associate with these things, and there is, I think, the fact that these individuals are able to manipulate the media and manipulate the police. They take on this cult status. You know, I mean, Charles Manson, who was just up for parole yet again and denied, is still, a cult hero. I mean, if you go on the internet, it's unbelievable, the merchandise, the Charles Manson merchandise. You can literally buy a little Charles Manson onesie for your baby. I mean, I don't know who would do that, but there are people out there who collect and purchase those kind of things. So, yes, there's definitely an audience out there that is fascinated by these individuals. And I must admit to myself, I am fascinated by by their minds and how they operate, and I think a lot of us are.
Doctor, I've heard people say when talking about killers, not necessarily serial killers, but it could apply to them also, they'll say, well, that guy, whoever did that, had to be a nut. They
mm-hmm.
should be able to catch him in a heartbeat. And my contention is, having maybe some type of mental issue or condition doesn't necessarily make you stupid.
Oh, God, no.
You can, in fact,
not.
Maybe just the opposite.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, that's the point. These individuals, the true psychopaths, the Bundys, for example, they're intelligent individuals, and they're not... to the average person, you know, to the layman, they would say, how can you possibly kill these strangers and do these horrible things and dismember and do the terrible things that they do and not be crazy? Well, from the standpoint of the American Medical Association and diagnostics and the true definitions of mental illness, they don't fit. A psychopath is actually an antisocial personality disorder, and it's not a mental illness. These individuals, they don't have delusions, they don't see aberrations and things that aren't there. What they really have, as I was saying earlier, is just a complete disconnect to society, a disconnect to other human beings, which is what enables them to, you know, to do these terrible things. But yes, because they're cold-blooded and calculating, they're actually much more effective at what they do. That's why they're so difficult to apprehend. I would not suggest that anyone jump to the conclusions that they're easy to catch, or because they're crazy, or that they're at home, out of their minds, because they're not. They're anything but. They're cold and calculating.
And do you think, Doctor, that when do these people give away perhaps to their friends or people close to, maybe their families, do they exhibit conduct perhaps when growing up or once they start doing what they're doing? Should someone who knows them be able to pick up on that or know? I mean, would they give anything away, or could they act perfectly normal where no one would have a clue that they were at night or whatever, or at weekends, or going out and murdering people?
Well, again, a great question. Some of them who are true psychopaths are able to very effectively function in society. John Wayne Gacy was a civic leader in his community, and he was admired and respected by everyone, and yet he was killing and torturing young men and burying them under his house at the same time. And Dennis Rader, the BTK strangler, was the pillar of his community, the president of his church, Boy Scout leader, had his own business, married, raised two children, and yet he was capturing, torturing, killing, and destroying lives for a period of almost 30 years. So, yes, some of these individuals are very, very capable of we call it compartmentalization. It's almost like they have two separate lives. They have their seemingly normal life, and then they have this other life, and they're able to flip a switch and go from one to the other.
And we have to flip a switch because we're out of time. People need to go to your website. It's www.docbonn.com. You've been so gracious 2 weeks in a row, last week and this week. We are so appreciative. Again, everybody, the website is www.docbonn.com. Thank you to the CrimeWire team, our director of research, Kim Colton, the public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be April 24th, 2012. Tune in and we continue to analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and havoc on families looking for justice and seeking answers.
Thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com, turn on the volume at your computer, and the show will automatically play. And remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the CrimeWire team, Denny Griffin and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night. And thanks so much, Doctor. It's been absolutely fascinating.
It's my pleasure anytime, and I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, sir.
Good night, everybody.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.